The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. First up is an article from the January 27, 2025 issue of the New Yorker. What an insomniac knows. What's really going on when you can't power down? By Adam Gopnik. Are you awake? So runs the perpetual 3 a.m. question of the sleepless to the seemingly slumbering partner. No, the partner replies, turning over and away, indicating both the fact of being awake and the state of being still asleep, unavailable for conscious activities. The insistent insomniac, desperate for a chat, usually sighs, accepts the verdict, and slumps back into sleeplessness. Carrying on with the conversation is a path toward divorce, not the desired diversion. The exchange, muttered by countless couples in countless beds, reminds us that sleep is not a neat off-and-on switch, but a fully human and fiendishly manifold activity, social, complex, and governed by as many psychological intricacies as any other natural act. We can be asleep and still sense that something is stirring around us, or be awake and still say no and mean it. The importance of insomnia is so colossal that I am tempted to define man as the animal who cannot sleep. E. M. Cioran once wrote, "Sleep, which when things go well consumes a third of our lives, poses two opposed existential perplexities. The first is about consciousness. We know that we sleep, but cannot know that we are sleeping, since sleep is, in its nature, non-present. The second perplexity has to do with what we can, in fact, remember, and that is the experience of dreams. While engaged in the non-knowable act of sleeping, we also learn nightly that it is possible to know that we have had vivid, intense, unforgettable experiences that are, at the same time, delusions. Sleep tells us that there are black holes outside the possibility of narrative description. The dreams we have when we're sleeping tell us that our entire existence might be a narrative fiction. How do we know it's not a dream? Is the perennial philosopher's question, the red pill dilemma. We've all felt that initial squeeze of relief. Oh, it was just a dream. Turn into sadness. Oh, he's not alive again. It was only a dream. And so the contradiction. We cannot narrate our experience of sleep, even though our dreams are so much our primary experience of narration, that we use them as a metaphor for our most extreme actualities. It was like a dream, we say of something piercingly happy. It was a nightmare for something piercingly sad. Inevitably, we turn to the scientists, as medieval people to the stars, in the hope of finding truth and comfort about our unwaking states. In Why We Sleep, Matthew Walker, who runs the Center for Human Sleep Science at the University of California at Berkeley, offers a fine, condensed account of what students of consciousness know about its absence. He is at pains to show that there's a complex architecture of unconsciousness. It isn't just that deep sleep is followed by REM sleep or dreaming sleep. These two states firmly oscillate back and forth in the hours we are asleep. We learn not just about melatonin as a marker of our circadian rhythm, but about adenosine, which accumulates during our waking hours and produces the sleep pressure, or homeostatic sleep drive, that makes us drowsy. Caffeine, we're told, does its work by preventing adenosine from doing its work. It's a powerful drug. Walker reproduces terrifying drawings of webs woven by spiders under the influence of various substances. Spiders do okay, even on LSD, but go completely crazy on the strength of a couple of lattes, spinning wildly incoherent webs that would never catch a fly. Veteran insomniacs seeking reassurance in these pages, it's no big deal. People manage fine with minimal sleep. It gets better. We'll find none. Instead, we are warned that the consequences of not sleeping are even worse than we had feared. Everything goes wrong when we don't sleep. The damage to our immune system is astounding. Walker cites a study of healthy young men that showed how a four-hour night of sleep swept away 70% of the natural killer cells circulating in the immune system. Sleep-deprived mice, it seems cruel to keep even mice awake, but we do, possibly by showing them election night on MSNBC over and over. Anyway, these sleep-deprived mice will have a 200% increase in tumor growth. Nor is cancer the only risk. You don't need a full night of total sleep deprivation to inflict a measurable impact on your cardiovascular system, Walker explains, delivering details with what sounds suspiciously like professional delight. He writes, as your sleep-deprived heart beats faster, the volumetric rate of blood pumped through your vasculature increases, and with that comes the hypertensive state of your blood pressure. Adding insult to real injury, the hypertensive strain that sleep deprivation places on your vasculature means that you can no longer repair those fracturing vessels effectively. Vessels will rupture. It is a powder keg of factors, with heart attack and stroke being the most common casualties in the explosive aftermath. That's the kind of reading that can keep you up at night. Insomniacs tend to couple up neatly with good sleepers, but even those good sleepers are probably not sleeping as much as they should. Walker suggests that humans are made for biphasic sleep, that is, two sleep sessions per day. People in traditional communities where everyone naps live longer than people in modernized ones where they don't. The siesta is life-saving. Walker even conjectures that our peculiar sleep patterns may explain our evolutionary advance. We sleep less than other primates, but get relatively more REM sleep and the dreams it brings than our monkey and ape cousins. It is during REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, Walker insists, that we engage in emotional processing. The mnemonic collisions during this phase forge new connections among our experiences, and we wake not merely refreshed, but revived and enlightened by our rewrought neural networks. That's if you sleep, of course. Insomnia seems to descend alarmingly like schizophrenia in the late teens when self-consciousness of all types descends. I suffered my own first serious bout with sleeplessness around the age of 18 when, coming home from a family voyage to Europe, my eyes would not shut. The reason was obviously jet lag, but instead of accepting the cause, I internalized the panic. Decades later, I recall good sleeps the way other people recall good meals. I have luckily had too many good meals to recall almost any. The one morning when I slept past 9, that other when the kids had to wake me at 11, even phobias can be quite as psychologically painful as sleeplessness. The body simply won't lose consciousness, and losing it is something that cannot be willed into existence, or rather, into non-existence. And so, one begins to envy desperately, not just the sleeping spouse, but everyone in the world who is not awake, from children to the henchmen in the old heist movies who are thumped on the head with the butt of a gun by Steve McQueen and immediately faint away. Not something that can actually happen. The odyssey that the insomniac undergoes every night, passing from bedroom to living room and back again, is, in a curious way, a parody of sleep. as Walker depicts it, with a conscious architecture of its own. Not being able to sleep and being awake are two distinct settings. Insomniacs seldom just get up, work for an hour, enjoy the silence of the house. This implies a state of serenity that's exactly what we don't have. If we could be that calm, we'd be asleep. No, we are inclined to seek out sleep in the same oscillating stages that sleep itself presents. Even if that means walking fretfully or listening to podcasts on early Christian history or watching late night television, searching out things that will be sufficiently distracting to keep us from dwelling on the fact that we are not sleeping without being so agitating as to keep us up even more. Star insomniacs, for there are such people, tend to feel free to externalize their own nightly odyssey. The basketball player Wilt Chamberlain was chronically sleep-deprived. He would talk about how little sleep he'd had, and crankily, not boastfully. The 1970s were probably the best time of his life because he had people who could stay up all night with him, a friend of his has said. But he'd wear people out because all the rest of us had to sleep. There were compensations. He couldn't have slept with so many women, many, many thousands, he estimated, had he actually slept. This double use of sleep, which occurs in many languages, is a significant substitution. Sex being both an alternative before and a soporific after. Perhaps he slept with so many in order to sleep alone. What afflicts the great star of the court can equally afflict the great star of the quad. The eminent philosopher of personhood, Derek Parfit, served himself a nightly concoction of pills and vodka in an effort to knock himself out. According to his biographer, David Edmonds, the druggings were accompanied by another ritual in the pre-AirPods era, when Parfit was a fellow at All Souls College, Oxford. Each night, as other fellows retired to bed, he would start playing Wagner, usually the Ring Cycle, Tristan and Isolde, or Parsifal, and the music would float across the North Quad for several hours. Wagner would be a sleepless highbrow's favorite. The long, lush, unbroken lines of music share with the white noise hum of the air conditioner or the thrum of the painstaking lecture, the quality of being absorbing without offering undue eventfulness. It doesn't seem to have helped Parfit any more than early Christian history has helped me. The exasperated experts, right here, began to fire off emails and DMs, tutting at the eminent philosopher's obvious failures of sleep hygiene. Of course, if you drink vodka, you'll wake up at midnight. Walker, in fact, explains that one of the byproducts of alcohol metabolism is a class of chemicals known as aldehydes that are especially prone to impede REM sleep. But trust us, doctor, we have tried it all. The Mayo Clinic has just published a brand new guide to sleeping, which rehearses yet again the familiar remedies and warnings. No caffeine within 9 hours of bedtime, done. No alcohol within 4 hours of bedtime, done. Exercise, but at least 2 hours prior, done. No screens before bed, done. Meditation can help, does sort of, and calculation can comfort. See how much you're really sleeping by keeping a record, and you'll be vaguely encouraged that it's more than you know. Melatonin, the cautious man's Valium, may or may not work, and the gummies may contain much less or much more of the active ingredient than the label promises. The veteran insomniac may arrive at a neat little stack of health food store supplements, CBD gummies, with or without THC, L-theanine, kava, valerian root, and so on. And she is perfectly aware that more likely than not, it works if it works as a placebo. One would think that placebos to work could not be known as such, but it seems that when we need something badly enough, we welcome anything. We are told to find consolation in the creative and prolific souls who share the affliction. The Brontes, Baudelaire, Kafka, Proust, Nabokov. Wilt Chamberlain didn't catch a wink of sleep in Syracuse the night before his 100-point game. But then the number of unlikable people who slept 4 hours or so out of 24 includes such dubious sorts as Napoleon and Kissinger. Is it possible that they tried, consciously or otherwise, to sacrifice sleep for self-interest? The cognitive cost may be compensated by the careerist advantages. The inevitable reaction to the universalizing claims of natural science is the particularizing claims of cultural history. Sleep, we can be certain, will be shown to have as many cultural styles over time as the pajamas we wear, or don't wear, to enjoy it. Though food is biologically necessary, we accept that it has innumerable local styles. There may be a universal grammar of a pungent protein piled upon a neutral starch, but it encompasses everything from pizza to cassava with spiced ants. Can sleep have something like the same tribal variety? Is there a peculiarly Sri Lankan siesta, an especially Swedish kind of slumber party? Right on cue, we have Sebastian P. Klinger's Sleep Works, Experiments in Science and Literature, 1899 to 1929. It's an attempt to cross the wires of experimental sleep science with those of literary production, set as the 19th century turned into the 20th. A devout culturalist, Klinger quotes approvingly the statement that there is nothing natural about going to bed, and yet if anything is natural, that is common to almost the entire animal kingdom, it's sleep. Although beds, in our modern sense of four-footed furniture with a springy surface, may have a particular history, the familiar use of bed to mean something soft that animals choose to lie down on is obviously wide-reaching. Hibernating bears do not lie on jagged rocks. The statement means, really, that the way we sleep is more inflected by our beliefs than we might think, as touched by our private yens as our public yawns. Klinger's subsequent thesis, not a terribly surprising one, is that insomnia is a consequence of the mechanization of leisure by capitalism, and that we became sleepless because we were being forced to work and shop. Insomnia is the occupational disease of enslaved mind workers, with a predictable spillover into the aesthetes who mock it yet participate in it. But surely insomnia was, as it remains, an outlier issue. Henry Clay Frick appeared to have slept fine, and Frederick Winslow Taylor, who slept poorly as an adolescent, doesn't seem to have slept worse after he pioneered the methods of industrial efficiency. In ancient Rome, Juvenal complained about being kept up all night by the city's noise. Perhaps the special connection between insomnia and modernity is something we want to be true. Insomnia seems no more a generally modern complaint than it is a capitalist one. It is specifically a romantic complaint, which began to be heard in full right around the start of the 19th century and, like so many romantic complaints, became most intensified as it passed from country to city. If Shakespeare produced, in Lady Macbeth, the first great insomniac of English literature, albeit one who sees the condition as a punishment from God, it was Wordsworth who wrote our first real poem about insomnia. It's disarming in its narrator's search for some form of the white noise that sometimes helps the sleepless. He was trying to find pacifying country sounds, even in the Lake District, the kind that are now synthesized on Spotify. A clock of sheep that leisurely pass by, one after one, the sound of rain and bees, murmuring the fall of rivers, winds, and seas, smooth fields, white sheets of water, and pure sky. I've thought of all by turns, and still I lie, sleepless. What is essential is the taste to testify to the extremes of experience. Coleridge's Somnambulist and Wordsworth's Insomniac are two sides of a single phenomenon. Klinger, to his credit, recognizes that the opposite side of the failure to sleep is the fetishization of sleep. Proust's insomnia, though debilitating, was made in a classic wound and bow terms into the engine of his art. And so with Kafka and Cioran not being permitted to sleep by the lights of modernity, we make a melancholy playground out of the prohibition. Klinger also points out that this era marks the birth of the sleeping pill, the communion wafer of the new century, with all its attendant misery. Although sleeping drinks have an ancient history, evolving into the stupefactives of medieval medicine, and then, starting in the 16th century, the much-consumed tincture of opium known as laudanum, the 20th century was a time of unexampled innovation in this area. We are soon launched into the series of hypnotics, the barbiturates, the benzodiazepines, the Z-drugs, such as zolpidem, and most recently, the orexin blockers, notably Belsomra. Like the rakes in a Jane Austen novel, they all begin with great charm and then soon afterward earn the most terrible reputations. You would think we'd avoid the next generation of pills after seeing the toll extracted by the previous one, but we don't. The essayist Wilfred Sheed wrote, in the 1990s, a funny, agonized book about his betrayal by benzo, in his case, Ativan, which promised much and ended up in collaboration with alcohol, sending its otherwise well-balanced user off to a procession of rehabs. Sheed called New York the world's insomnia capital. This may be true, but what sane person would exchange the gleaming city at 3 a.m. for the farmhouse at 9 p.m., with all the exhausted hoers and threshers briefly asleep until the next dawn's labor begins again? When our own country cousins come south from Canada, they emerge from the spare bedroom of our New York apartment hollow-eyed and sleepless, politely incapable of understanding how anyone can sleep amid the noise of ambulances and car alarms and honking cabs and city buses sweeping up the avenue right outside. Among the New Yorkers, both the good sleepers and the bad sleepers don't notice it. What of the dreams that sleep brings? If anything is universal, it is the belief across cultures that dreams are parables and portents. Freud became famous for seeking symbolic significance in dreams, but it is hard to find a single culture that does not include some version of this belief. The ancient Greeks thought that dreams held powers of prophecy. Hindus have apparently found encouragement in dreams of Lord Krishna. We want dreams to mean something, even though, yet another slumber paradox, they mainly puzzle us by their disjuncture of logic and meaning. Thus, the dreamer later, there is usually only one in a relationship, always begins, "I had the strangest dream last night." To find out what the new science of dreams suggests, we have This Is Why You Dream by Raoul Zondiol, whose name on the dust jacket is suspiciously followed by both MD and PhD. A good rule of reading being that the more credentials on the cover, the less convincing the claims inside. Yet John Dial's book, though perhaps breezier and less cautious than that of the more typical sleep scientist, is filled with empirical information that may seem dreamy without ever feeling wholly hallucinated. And so we learn of the Holly Berry neuron, a discovery of the neuroscientist Rodrigo Quian Quiroga, who found that in one experimental subject, a single neuron fired to the invocation or even the mention of Halle Berry. The larger point being made, very much in harmony with Matthew Walker's theory of human nightly emotional processing, is that our dreams are what John Dial calls thought experiments. We focus with such neural narrowness on Halle Berry or on Brad Pitt because having fantasy figures play roles in the stock theater company of the night helps prepare us to ensnare the real thing in our waking hours. If there seems less evidence than we might want for such a confident claim, John Dial does make a plausible case that our dreams work in tandem with our theory of mind, our ability to grasp that other people are thinking and feeling in the same way as ourselves. At night, we rehearse the day's actions, and our imaginations, so to speak, ruminate through the activities of those others we have encountered as though they were our own and try to make lateral sense of them. Throughout, John Dial is arguing against the continuity hypothesis of dreaming, the idea that dreams are basically extensions of our daily life in coded form. Instead, he thinks that the purpose of dreams is closer to the vernacular meaning of the word. It's what we want, not what we got. The outer edge of our imagination, not the fabric of our days we rove in. Sometimes, to be sure, dreams are obviously rooted in anxiety. We dream repeatedly of having signed up for a course that we forgot to attend, with the exam now drawing near. This may be the mind's simple post-it reminder not to do this, or anything similar. Others are more plaintively compensatory. A standard dream of New Yorkers is to have found an extra room in their apartment. A dream often elaborated with a Narnia-like act of pushing back coats and clothes to find a secret door in the back of a closet. We awake, sadly, to the same space we had before. To this dream, one might add another, also seemingly peculiar to New York City. Having acquired a bigger apartment, we dream of having been forced back to the smaller one. But most dreams are less shapely in their signaling, tending to be the jangle of mixed-up stories and abruptly abbreviated actions which puzzle us in the morning. And so John Dial arrives at a highly hypothetical but agreeably plausible explanation, modeled, as such explanations usually are, on the most recent available model of the mind. In our case, that model is provided by artificial intelligence. When a system of machine learning becomes overly tethered to the material it is dredging and, John Dial writes, grows too rigid and formulaic in its analysis, it proves useful to inject noise into the information used to teach the machine, deliberately corrupting the data and making the information more random. Dreams, therefore, are much like the noise injected into the machine's data. Freeing our minds, dreams force us into new channels of possibility, which might, in their apparently surreal inconsequence, lead to the type of thinking that looks at a problem in a completely novel way and helps us find adaptive solutions to unexpected threats. The illogic of dreams is not a riddle to be solved, but a noise that can reveal the meaningful signal. We are readied for the unexpected by the nightly experience of the inexplicable. But there's also something to the old saying that dreams go by contraries. Far from being continuous with our daily life, they are often compensatory. One abashed sleep scientist long ago, anticipating that the leaders of an expedition to Everest would have the most epic dreams, discovered that the meekest and most incompetent followers dreamed heroically of the summit, while others' dreams tended to be far more anxious. A Walter Mitty effect that should have been predictable to any reader of fiction. Jean Dial urges us to take advantage of dream disjunctions by making a conscious effort to record our unconsciousness, writing down the previous night's dreams, to which we are usually made amnesiac by the reemergence of the executive function of the brain in wakefulness, so that retreating into our dreams can expand our minds in ways impossible in lived experience. On the farther shore of sleep, John Dial writes encouragingly of the willed practice of lucid dreaming, that is, of shaping our minds so that our dreams are not merely orderly, but intentionally helpful. We focus on seeing the divine, And we're told that some version of the divine will be seen that night, though Hindus will see Krishna and Christians Christ. The practice of lucid dreaming would seem to clash with John Dale's earlier theory of useful randomness in dreaming. But then, why should dreams be any more subject to a unitary principle than any other part of life? This particular non-lucid dreamer made an effort, after reading John Dial, to dream the divine, but I kept getting instead the missed exam and the extra room in the apartment. Perhaps evidence that dreams will elude the strictures of lucidity, or perhaps evidence only that, for a New Yorker, the extra room is the image of the divine. A skeptic might insist that dreams have no real content at all and are more like bits and pieces of film in the cutting room of the mind. The morning after recitation might be the dream, that is, the moment when the clips are run through the projector and we patch together a narrative. The mind then might make purpose in dreams rather than find it there. How much are those purposes affected by our situation? According to the clinical literature supporting a version of the continuity hypothesis, prisoners in Auschwitz dreamed of continued suffering in which the misery and horror persisted, or had positive dreams of escape that they could share with other prisoners. One prisoner after the war described a dream in which he met his murdered brother on a stream, the deep river that represents the passage from sleep to death in countless mythologies, and his brother handed him a fiery fish. "I can't carry it. I can't carry it," the dreamer remembers crying. "You'll carry it. You'll carry it," his long-gone brother insisted. The dream, he said, gave him courage and helped him survive. Those of us stuck on the wheel of sleeplessness eventually discover what the scientists concede, that nothing is gained past a certain point in trying to sleep. Since the one sure thing is that none of us can will ourselves to sleep. The best remedy for insomnia, as with most things in life, is learning to live with it. In time, we come to understand that the psychological cost of stressing over sleeplessness is greater than the physical cost of not having slept. And so we adjust. The fact of not having slept turns out to be tolerable. Exhaustion gives way to normal energy, and adrenaline kicks in when we have to perform. We cope. Is there a more dispiriting but mature reflection? Yet, on the whole, we do cope and find comfort. Insomnia is a mark of the insubordinate imagination. On the 13th century tomb of Eleanor of Aquitaine, she is shown wide awake and reading, while her dull and kingly husband sleeps for all eternity. Doubtless some medievalist will explain this as a conventional funerary trope, but one cannot help but feel, looking at it, that it is an allegory about the virtues of sleeplessness. Eleanor can read a book or, these days, scroll through her phone. Her mind is secretly and subversively open. I simply cannot get used to the nightly betrayal of reason, humanity, genius. No matter how great my weariness, the wrench of parting with consciousness is unspeakably repulsive to me. So declared Nabokov. And though, as often with that great exile, there is a note of overcompensating defiance in the affirmation, still, he had a point. There is glory in this view of life, which involves extending its conscious moments, fighting for every second of awareness that our mortality can afford us. The one thing the insomniac does not envy is the unconscious dead. The universe, after all, is asleep. Trees and vegetation are always slumbering, helpless at the woodsman's axe or the casual munching of a ruminant. And the great mass of inanimate matter is flattered by even being called asleep. It has no potential for animation. To be awake is to be alive. Mind racing at 3 a.m., we are in tune with what may be the truly unique, only once in the universe gift of consciousness. That is some comfort. We will sleep long enough, soon enough. Next, from the January 27, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, what if the attention crisis is all a distraction? From the pianoforte to the smartphone, each wave of tech has sparked fears of brain rot. But the problem isn't our ability to focus, it's what we are focusing on, by Daniel Immerwahr. There are awards for this year's best films, but not for its best TikTok videos. That's too bad, since 2024 yielded several tiny masterpieces. Such internet gems are what the poet Patricia Lockwood has called the sapphires of the instant. Each catches the light in a strange, hypnotic way. Just don't stare too long. If every video is a starburst of expression, an extended TikTok session is fireworks in your face for hours. That can't be healthy, can it? In 2010, the technology writer Nicholas Carr presciently raised his concern in The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. What the net seems to be doing, Carr wrote, is chipping away my capacity for concentration and contemplation. He recounted his increased difficulty reading longer works. He wrote of a highly accomplished philosophy student, indeed a Rhodes Scholar, who did not read books at all, but gleaned what he could from Google. That student, Carr ominously asserted, seems more the rule than the exception. It's been 15 years since Carr's The Shallows. Now we have what is perhaps the most sophisticated contribution to the genre, The Siren's Call by Chris Hayes, an MSNBC anchor. Hayes acknowledges the long history of such panics. Some seem laughable in hindsight, he concedes, like one in the 1950s about comic books. Yet others seem prophetic, like the early warnings about smoking. It's the development of a global, ubiquitous, chronically connected social media world more like comic books or cigarettes, Hayes asks. Great question. If we take the skeptics seriously, how much of the catastrophist argument stands? Enough, Hayes feels, that we should be gravely concerned. We have a country full of megaphones, a crushing wall of sound, the swirling lights of a 24/7 casino blinking at us, all part of a system minutely engineered to take our attention away from us for profit, he writes. Thinking clearly and conversing reasonably under these conditions is like trying to meditate in a strip club. The case he makes is thoughtful, informed, and disquieting. But is it convincing? History is littered with lamentations about distraction. Swirling lights and strippers are not a new problem. What's important to note about bygone debates on the subject, though, is that they truly were debates. Not everyone felt the sky was falling, and the dissenters raised pertinent questions. Is it, in fact, good to pay attention? Whose purposes does it serve? Such questions came up in the 18th century with the rise of a disruptive new commodity, the novel. Although today's critics rue our inability to get through long novels, such books were once widely regarded as the intellectual equivalent of junk food. They fix attention so deeply and afford so lively a pleasure that the mind, once accustomed to them, cannot submit to the painful task of serious study. The Anglican priest Vicissimus Knox complained. Thomas Jefferson warned that once readers fell under the spell of novels, this mass of trash, they would lose patience for wholesome reading. They'd suffer from bloated imagination, sickly judgment, and disgust toward all the real business of life. Whatever thoughts past writers have had about the virtues of attention, pessimists would argue that the problem is different now. It's as if we are not reading books so much as the books are reading us. TikTok is particularly adept at this. You just scroll and the app learns, from your behavior plus perhaps other information harvested from your phone, about what will keep you hooked. I wake up in cold sweats every so often thinking, what did we bring to the world? Tony Fadell, a co-developer of the iPhone, has said. As a baseline, Chris Hayes points to Abraham Lincoln's debates with Stephen A. Douglas in the 1850s, three-hour exchanges of orations about a momentous topic, slavery. He marvels at how complex and layered the speeches were, stuffed with parenthetical and nested clauses, with ideas that are previewed at the beginning of a sentence, left for a bit, and then returned to later. He imagines what sheer stamina of focus Lincoln and Douglas's audiences must have possessed. Those audiences were large. Would voters flock to something similar today? Not likely, Hayes says. Information now comes in ever shorter little bites, and focus is harder and harder to sustain. Hayes has seen this firsthand. His illuminating backstage account of cable news describes thoughtful journalists debasing themselves in their scramble to retain straying viewers. Garish graphics, loud voices, quick topic changes, and titillating stories. It's like jangling keys to lure a dog. The more viewers get their news from apps, the harder television producers have to shake those keys. The situation is, in some sense, our fault, as the whole system runs on our own choices. But those choices don't always feel free. Hayes distinguishes between voluntary and compelled attention, some things we focus on by choice, others, because of our psychological hardwiring, we find hard to ignore. Digital tools let online platforms harness the latter, addressing our involuntary impulses rather than our high-order desires. The algorithms deliver what we want, but not, as the late philosopher Harry Frankfurt put it, what we want to want. Getting what we want, not what we want to want, it could be the slogan of our times. Hayes notes that it's not only corporations that hone in on our baser instincts. Since social media users have also access to immediate feedback, they learn what draws eyeballs, too. Years ago, Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and Kanye West had hardly anything in common. Now their pursuit of publicity has morphed into versions of the same persona, the attention troll, and despite ourselves, we cannot look away. The painful twist is that climate change, the thing we really ought to focus on, evades our attentional faculties, Hayes writes. It's always been a problem, the writer and activist Bill McKibben told him, that the most dangerous thing on the planet is invisible, odorless, tasteless, and doesn't actually do anything to you directly. Global warming is the opposite of Kanye West. We want to pay attention, but we don't. The trouble is attention capitalism, Hayes argues, and it has the same dehumanizing effect on consumers' psyches as industrial capitalism has on workers' bodies. Successful attention capitalists don't hold our attention with compelling material, but instead snatch it over and over with slot machine gimmicks. They treat us as eyeballs rather than individuals, cracking into our minds and leaving us twitching. Our dominion over our own minds has been punctured, Hayes writes. The scale of transformation we're experiencing is far more vast and more intimate than even the most panicked critics have understood. What's awkward about this whole debate is that, though we speak freely of attention spans, they are not the sort of thing that psychologists can measure independent of context across time. And studies of the ostensible harm that carrying smartphones does to cognitive abilities have been contradictory and inclusive. ADHD diagnoses abound, but is that because the condition is growing more prevalent or the diagnosis is? U.S. labor productivity and the percentage of the population with 4 years or more of college have risen throughout the Internet era. The apparent decline of reading is also not so straightforward. Print book sales are holding steady, and audiobook sales are rising. The National Center for Education Statistics has tracked a recent drop in U.S. children's reading abilities, yet that mostly coincides with the pandemic, and scores are still as good as, or better than, when the center started measuring in 1971. If reading assignments at top colleges are shorter, it might be because today's hyper-competitive students are busier, rather than because they're less capable. And how many were actually doing all the reading in the old days? What about Nicholas Carr's insistence in 2010 that a Rhodes Scholar who didn't read books heralded a post-literate future? Of course I read books, that Rhodes Scholar protested to another writer. Today he holds a PhD from Oxford and has written two books of his own. After decades of the internet, the mediascape has still not dissolved into a froth of 3-second clips of orgasms, kittens, and trampoline accidents interspersed with sports betting ads. As the legal scholar Tim Wu argues in The Attention Merchants, the road to distraction is not one way. Yes, businesses seize our attention using the shiniest lures available, but people become inured and learn to ignore them. Or they recoil, which might explain why meditation, birdwatching, and vinyl records are in vogue. Technology firms, in fact, often attract users by promising to reduce distractions, not only the daily hassles, paying bills, arranging travel, but the online onslaught, too. Google's text ads and mail filters offered respite from the early internet spam and pop-ups. Apple became one of the world's largest companies by selling simplicity. Besides, distraction is relative. To be distracted from one thing is to attend to another. And any argument that people are becoming distracted must deal with the plain fact that many spend hours staring intently at their screens. What is doom scrolling if not avid reading? If people are failing to focus in some places, they're clearly succeeding in others. One place they're succeeding is cinema, which is in a Baroque phase. A leading Global Globe winner this year, The Brutalist, exceeds 3.5 hours. The average length of a top 10 grossing film grew by more than 20 minutes between 1993 and 2023. Hollywood's reliance on sequels and recycled intellectual property, were a hair's breadth from a crossover in which Thor fights the Little Mermaid, may have been terrible for cinema. It has, however, made for complicated movies tightly packed with backstory and fan service. The same goes for narrative television. It was once entertainment for the inattentive, with simple plots, broad jokes, and a tropical bird interrupting to shout about Fruit Loops. Yet that changed with cable, DVDs, and streaming shows. The first hit streaming series, Netflix's House of Cards, debuted in 2013. As writers stopped worrying about viewers losing the thread, their shows started resembling ultra-long films. Viewers responded by binge-watching, taking in hours of material in what Vince Gilligan, who created Breaking Bad, has called a giant inhalation. Or consider video games, which have grown mercilessly long. Years ago, in these pages, Alex Ross described Richard Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung, a cycle of 4 operas spanning about 15 hours, as arguably the most ambitious work of art ever attempted, and unlikely to have future rivals. In 2023, Larian Studios swept the video game awards with Baldur's Gate 3, a noticeably Wagnerian affair with rival gods, magic rings, enchanted swords, and dragons. 248 actors and some 400 developers worked on it. Playing through Baldur's Gate 3, an unhurried turn-based game with complex rules, can easily take 75 hours, or 5 ring cycles, and more than twice that if you're a completist. All the same, it has sold some 15 million copies. Even the supposedly attention-pulverizing TikTok deserves another look. Hayes, who works in TV, treats TikTok wholly as something to watch, an algorithmically individualized idiot box. But TikTok is participatory. More than half its U.S. adult users have posted videos. Where the platform excels is not in slick content, but in amateur enthusiasm, which often takes the form of trends with endless variations. To join in, TikTokers spend hours preparing elaborate dance moves, costume changes, makeup looks, lip syncs, trick shots, pranks, and trompe de l'oeil camera maneuvers. What's going on? The media theorist Neil Verma in Narrative Podcasting in an Age of Obsession describes the era of TikTok's rise as beset by obsession culture. Online media, by broadening the scope of possible interest, have given rise to an unabashedly nerdy intellectual style. Verma focuses on the breakout podcast Serial, whose first season in 2014 followed the host for hours as she pored over the details of a 15-year-old murder case. But deep dives into niche topics have become the norm. The wildly popular podcaster Joe Rogan runs marathon interviews, some exceeding 4 hours on ancient civilizations, cosmology, and mixed martial arts. A 4-hour video of the YouTuber Jenny Nicholson dissecting the design flaws of a defunct Disney World hotel has 11 million viewers. Deservedly, it's terrific. Hayes himself confesses to spending hours utterly transfixed by watching old carpets being shampooed. Are we, in staring at carpets, ignoring the weighty political matters? Hayes makes much of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, but the pair spoke without microphones to boisterous crowds numbering in the thousands, so it's highly unlikely that their audiences followed every word. The events included flowing alcohol also. It's also hard to admire the moral seriousness of a debate about slavery held on the eve of the Civil War, in which neither side proposed abolishing it. If the history of totalitarianism teaches anything, it's that long-winded orations do not always signify political health. Anyway, political verbosity, as measured by the State of the Union addresses, has risen during the 21st century. Donald Trump once spoke to CPAC for more than 2 hours. Famously, his digressive speeches require deep immersion in right-wing lore to comprehend. "I'll talk about like 9 different things and they all come back brilliantly together," Trump has boasted. The linguist John McWhorter has said of Trump's convoluted style that you have to almost parse it as if it was something in the Talmud. We blame the internet for polarizing politics and shredding attention spans, but those tendencies actually pull in opposite directions. What's true of culture is true of politics, too. As people diverge from the mainstream, they become obsessional and prone to scrambling down rabbit holes. Following QAnon takes a sort of born-again devotion that one expects of K-pop fan. Democratic socialists, vaccine skeptics, anti-Zionists, manosphere alphas, these are not people known for casual political engagement. Some may be misinformed, but they're not uninformed. Do your own research is the mantra of the political periphery. Fragmentation, it turns out, yields subcultural depths. Silos are not shallows. Hayes worries that the internet's political enthusiasm distract from global warming. And yet, conspicuously, it is young people, the most online of us all, who are leading the charge against climate change. The Gen Z activist Greta Thunberg is so good at publicizing the issue that media scholars write of a Greta effect. She's been raising hell online since age 15. If people aren't losing focus or growing complacent, what's the panic about? Complaints about distraction are most audible from members of the knowledge class. Journalists, artists, novelists, professors. Some people must summon creativity in long, unsupervised stretches, and so they are particularly vulnerable to online interruptions. Instagram vexes them in a way that it might not vex home health aides, retail salespeople, or fast food employees, to name the 3 most common types of U.S. workers. A larger part of the knowledge class problem is that cultural creators, especially those in legacy media, fear that smartphones will lure their audiences away. In this, they don't seem vastly different from 18th century priests decrying novels for turning women away from prayerful obedience. Is the ostensible crisis of attention at bottom a crisis of authority? Is people aren't paying attention just a dressed-up version of people aren't paying attention to me? The suspicion that all this is elite anxiety in the face of a democratizing mediascape deepens when you consider what the attentionists thus want people to focus on. Generally, it's fine art, old books, or untrammeled nature, as if they were running a Connecticut boarding school. Above all, they demand patience, the inclination to stick with things that aren't immediately compelling or comprehensible. Patience is indeed a virtue, but a whiff of narcissism arises when commentators extol it in others, like a husband praising an adoring wife. It places the responsibility for communication on listeners, giving speakers license to be overlong, unclear, or self-indulgent. When someone calls for audiences to be more patient, I instinctively think, alternatively, you could be less boring. In a sense, What attention alarmists seek is protection from a competition that they're losing. Fair enough. The market doesn't always deliver great results, and Hayes is right to deplore the commodification of intellectual life. But one can wonder whether ideas are less warped by the market when they are posted online to a free platform than when they are rolled into books, given barcodes, and sold in stores. It's worth remembering that those long 19th century novels were losing the patience to read were long for a reason. Profit-seeking publishers made authors drag out their stories across multiple volumes. Market forces have been stretching, squashing, spinning, and suppressing ideas for centuries. Realistically, the choice isn't commodified versus free, but which commodity form suits best. For Hayes, what makes the apps awful is that they operate without consent. They seize attention using tricks, leaving us helpless and stupefied. Yet even this argument, his most powerful, warrants caution. Our media have always done a weird dance with our desires. Although Hayes argues for the profound novelty of our predicament, the title of his book, The Siren's Call, alludes to a Homeric tale from antiquity of songs too alluring to resist. This isn't always unwelcome. Consider our highest words of praise for books. Captivating, commanding, riveting, absorbing, enthralling. It's a fantasy of surrendered agency. A page-turner, the pages turn themselves. Oddly, the thing we deplore in others, submission, is what we most want for ourselves. The nightmare the alarmists conjure is of a TikTok-addled screenager. This isn't a full picture of the present, though, and it might not reveal much about the future, either. Ours is an era of obsession as much as distraction, of long forms as much as short forms, of zeal as much as indifference. To ascribe our woes to a society-wide attention deficit disorder is to make the wrong diagnosis. Which is unfortunate, because our relationships to our smartphones are far from healthy. The mediascape is becoming a stormy sea of anxiety, envy, delusion, and rage. Our attention is being redirected in surprising and often worrying ways. The overheating of discourse, the rise of conspiratorial thinking, the hollowing out of shared truths, all these trends are real and deserve careful thought. The panic over lost attention is, however, a distraction. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll be sure to listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.